Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Learn to Love podcast, your guide to everything love, sex, intimacy, and relationships. Each week, your host, Zach Beach, interviews new experts on love, including couples therapists, relationship coaches, sex educators, and best-selling authors. Learn the best tips and cutting-edge wisdom to better love yourself, others, and the world. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, beautiful souls. Thank you so much for joining us on the Learn to Love podcast. I am your host, Zach Beach, and I'm here with the incredible couples counselor, author, and professor, Elaine Carney Gibson. Hello, Elaine. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I don't know that I can truly call myself a professor because I don't have that, you know, little special qualification that professors like to hold dear to their heart.
Oh.
And their egos sometimes. So, but yes, I have taught graduate courses. So that's true.
You definitely taught. You're a teacher at graduate level. In my mind, you're a professor. Yeah, you might not have that PhD, but I'm so looking forward to all the knowledge you have to share for us today. And today we'll be talking about self-empowerment in family systems. And for those that don't know, Elaine Carney Gibson is the director of the Marriage and Family Therapy Training Institute of the Link Counseling Center in Atlanta, Georgia. She has been practicing psychotherapy for over 50 years, specializing in relationship therapy. She has, as you just mentioned, taught graduate courses in marriage and family therapy for many years, and her new book is called Your Family Revealed, A Guide to Decoding the Patterns, Stories, and Belief Systems in Your Family, which is the topic for today's show. So how are you today, Elaine?
I'm well, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on.
So our topic for today is basically around family systems theory. And for those unfamiliar with this subject, where does it fit into other psychological theories? And what exactly is it?
Okay, I'll try to answer that briefly. In systems theory, relationship interactions and patterns become the focus of exploring human problems rather than focusing on individual psyches or pathologies. So this was kind of a new thing. It was a totally new paradigm that kind of came out after World War II. And at that point in time, it was, I think, a lot of psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, communication theorists, anthropologists, we're all thinking about, okay, we've seen these machines now that have what they call a feedback loop. So when something happens in the machine, it gives other parts of the machine information, and then it self-corrects, and it keeps, you know, communicating with itself. And so they thought, wait a minute, let's look at that model in terms of an individual. An individual isn't on isolation. An individual, you know, I think of it as concentric circles. There's the individual, there's the immediate family, extended family, community, country, world. So you have these concentric circles going out from the individual. So to look at the individual in isolation, of course, doesn't make sense. So they were wanting to look at it more in terms of relationship and relationship patterns, and how each individual is impacted by others in the family, and you know, how one person impacts the others. That's really what it's looking at. And so it was a pretty exciting time. It kind of started being, a lot was written about it in the 1960s, and then it kind of flowered, bloomed in the 1970s, and that's when I came on the scene. And I was very lucky to start working at one of the first family therapy centers in the country, the Link Counseling Center. And so I'm very pleased we've been around since 1971. I joined the staff in 1972. So obviously I like my work and I'm loving what I do. I love, we work with individuals, couples, and families. And so it fits into, I think, the mental health field in a lovely way, and brings a lot to it. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. So you've been using it for a long time. I assume that you have found it to be particularly helpful.
Well, absolutely. I think that I just really, when I was lucky enough to get to study with some of the folks who wrote the textbooks, who wrote the original books. And so it has been very exciting to me. And I do believe it's very helpful. Absolutely.
So it's not to be confused with internal family systems, right? That is something different.
Internal family systems, which I also really love with Richard Schwartz. Yes, it's not the same thing, but it can be. When I taught it as a family systems model, because we do internalize our family. And I actually kind of learned that again in the 1970s out of something called transactional analysis. And that was Eric Byrne who came along, and this was after Freud, who did the superego, ego, id in terms of ego states. But with Eric Byrne, he was looking at each of us, each individual carries in us a parent, an adult self, and a child self. So I had been looking at that model for many years. So I think internal family systems just breaks that down further into the different parts of self. Some of those parts come from family and messages we've gotten and learn and carry within ourselves. Others come from other places. But yes, there is some difference, but yet I think there is some inclusion.
So what I'm hearing from you is it started after World War II, really grew in prominence and in research, and had a more robust kind of theory in the 60s and 70s. So it's been around for a bit of a while. And what compelled you to write Your Family Revealed now?
Well, partly because I finally had time, raising three sons, being a psychotherapist, working and teaching courses. There wasn't a lot of time, but it was really out of the students in my courses, because I would assign them something, you know, in the textbook, and they had come back and maybe be a little confused. And so I would explain it, make it kind of fun. And they would say, why don't you write the textbook? I thought it was a very nice compliment. But I thought, well, at some point, if I ever write something, I want it to be something that can be used. And I want it to be able to be used by anyone who's interested, not just someone who's studying marriage and family therapy, but anybody who's really interested in kind of how they got to be who they are, how they think about things, what their patterns of relationships are, more about their communication. I wanted it to be for the general public. And so I decided finally to sit down and write that. And what I think is pretty easy way to understand some of these different concepts. And then at the end of each of my chapters, I have something called reflections and questions, so that you can take what you've just read in the chapter and apply it to your own life, your own experience in your family of origin, the family you grew up in, or the family you're in now, or the system you're in now. So I wanted to get it out there because I was hoping it could be useful.
Yes. Well, I appreciate you getting it out there because it is incredibly useful. And when you mentioned this idea of family systems therapy that looks at the relationships and interactions a person has rather than the focus on the individual, that is a common critique that some people have of psychology in general, is that it does look at a patient or a client as if they are some isolated and separate individual, and that their healing happens entirely on their own, when what really is happening is we're often hurt or created patterns in relationships when we were young, and we need to heal those patterns and grow through those patterns also in that same relationship. And I'm curious how you do kind of go about doing that, because obviously you're not bringing the rest of the family into the therapy room.
Well, I think it's sitting with the individual. If you're working with an individual, I do bring the family in often because I do family therapy. But if I'm working with an individual on their healing process, then it's really about what meaning did they give to their experience, not just the experience and their memory of it, which, you know, may or may not be what somebody else's memory would be of it, but that the meaning they gave to it. And then with that meaning, how they think and feel about themselves. So it's helping them, if you will, to either give with a new perspective, perhaps giving it a different meaning, but particularly then whatever they've decided about themselves out of that experience, to maybe then help them come up with some other ways of thinking about themselves. So if they've always had something happen and they think of themselves as the victim, okay, they perhaps were a victim, but they can also then think of themselves rather than walking around in the world, I'm a victim, is also, I'm resilient. I'm a survivor. So they can give it, they can think about that experience and think about themselves differently out of it.
I love that example, being able to shift our mind frame from thinking ourselves as a victim to thinking of ourselves as being resilient, and that we are almost even stronger because of the challenges that we have gone through.
Well, we hope that could be true. We know that, you know, there's some things that have been just so damaging and wounding, but that we as humans are resilient, and we certainly can give ourselves, we can have different self-talk, is what I call it, because we talk to ourselves all the time, and we decide who we are and how we fit in the world. So, all right, maybe we can make some new decisions about that, who we are and how we fit in the world and how we relate to others and how we can have healing, positive relationships.
Yeah. So that brings me to just thinking about what the mechanism is. So when you mention like we might have negative self-talk, we might think and feel about ourselves in a not very positive way. How does that continue to be determined by my family system? So how does my family system affect me today?
Well, I think that it does impact all of us, and we carry around things that we kind of absorbed as a sponge. We may not even be really think conscious of it. And then we realize all of a sudden, because something happens in our lives, that we're operating out of this old framework that may be working for us and it may not be working for us. If it's not working for us, then we want to take a look at that, which is, I'm hoping when people are reading my book, they're hopefully taking a look at some of that and saying, this isn't working for me. I want to shift that into some other kind of thinking, understanding, of course, that comes first, the awareness and understanding, and then creating some how we want to think about it, which might be different, and then taking some action that could be different than what we've taken in the past. So I think that the messages we get, sometimes they're kind of loud and we know we have them. Other times they may be a little softer. An example could be, I grew up in a family that was geared towards the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Now, a lot of your younger listeners may not know some of these old sayings, but there are a lot of them. And so that was kind of how my family lived. If we saw something that was going to break, it got fixed before it got broken. If you knew, you know, so things, an ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. Okay, I'm just going along with that because that's how I lived. But then all of a sudden, I am in relationship with someone who kind of their family motto was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's another old saying. Okay, so that's a very different approach to the world. So I'm not aware that I'm kind of living out of that place. But then when I meet something that doesn't quite work with that, then I understand that, okay, we come from different perspectives. And if it's someone that I'm in a close relationship with, then we're going to have to kind of figure out how we want to deal with that. So I think the family, it gets in there. Like I said, we're sponges, particularly when we're young. So we're picking up information about who we are in the world, what the world is. So it's always there. And as we go through different stages in our life, we may recognize something in our 40s we didn't recognize in our 20s. Or we get to our 60s and we recognize something that we're carrying that we didn't pay much attention to because it really wasn't something that we needed to pay much attention to. And now we do. So it's just always there.
Yeah, it's so interesting hearing your example, because first what I'm hearing is like these messages we received from our family could work. They could be good. Like fix it before it gets more broken, or if it's ain't broke, don't fix it. These are both kind of appropriate words of wisdom. But then when my family system meets another person's family system and we attempt to create a relationship together, the different messages that might have worked for both respective family systems now suddenly clash.
Exactly. I see that a lot. And I frequently say it when I'm doing couple therapy. We come in with a set of expectations, perhaps, about what it means to be in this relationship. And the other person comes in with perhaps a different set of expectations. And so that we have to kind of figure that out. We have different messages, how we see the world, how we fit into the world, how we fit into our families, how we're going to relate to our extended families. And that all becomes something that we want to consider.
So let's say I want to get to better know my own family system. You write about in your book this importance of self-knowledge and that knowledge is power. So how do I go about getting a better understanding of my own family system that I am often unconsciously bringing into every relationship I enter into?
Yeah, well, I think that awareness is the first thing. And certainly we can do that by reading. That's one of the reasons I wrote my book, is to help people be more aware, to have a better understanding about the family system, and then to kind of identify those places that are working and not working, because that is where our power is and our choice. Do I want to continue? An example I'm thinking of just to kind of comes up for me is, I'm thinking of three sisters and that they're close in age and that they have this triangle, because that's one of the patterns we see in families is triangles. And then the triangle is one sister is the one where the other two always call her to try to engage her, to try to fix something. That they're mad at the other, they disagree with the other, and they pull this person, want to pull this person in to be on their side, to agree with them. So if the individual, who's the sister who's being sought out to be kind of pulled on to be on either side, realizes, I'm in this triangle, awareness, understanding of how that I operate in that triangle, and then to decide, do I want to stay in the triangle? There's your choice. There's the power, the choice. No, I don't think so. So then what's the action that I can take to no longer be in that place of being the one who tries to get pulled in to be on either side? How can I set my boundaries? What can I say that's honoring of myself, but, you know, also not being mean to the other people? How can I basically honor myself in setting boundaries and at the same time have regard and respect for the other person? So that's where the power comes in. The power comes in the choice. After the awareness and understanding of what is happening, to make that decision, do you want it to continue? That's the choice. And if you don't, then the choice of what action you're going to take to do it differently.
Mm, I love that. It's very straightforward, almost four-step process. Awareness, understanding, choice, and action.
It's not as easy as it sounds. But basically, yes. Yeah.
I'm curious how you as a therapist go about figuring out one of your clients' internal family system, especially around how people are often almost unreliable narrators of their own childhood, how memory can be quite fallible, how, you know, you might ask somebody, oh, well, how was your childhood? Oh, it was great. We don't need to talk about that. And, you know, even just this idea that as kids, we obviously had a very different perspective of the world than, say, our parents did, who were dealing with bills and jobs, and we were just annoyed that they didn't want to play with us for for the fifth hour that we wanted them to.
Well, the internal family system may certainly relate to our experiences in our family. And we may not remember things the way somebody else remembers them. But as I said earlier, I think it really has to do with the meaning we've given whatever our experience is and how we then define ourselves as I'm worthy, I'm lovable, I'm not, I'm a good person. All those messages, those messages we give ourselves that we walk around believing about ourselves. And so it is, again, okay, once you can realize that, okay, maybe you did, and you're right. People come in and they say, I don't need to talk about my childhood. My childhood was just great. Okay, well, tell me who was in your family. And I like to get three generations, at least. And then I really want to look at it as more than a family tree, because it's more than who's there and, you know, birth dates, death dates. But, okay, well, tell me about mental illness. Tell me about physical illness. Tell me about divorces and losses, moves, any kind of things that I think might have impacted the individual I'm sitting with. And as I get the history, then yes, in there, I may even think, yes, they had a lovely childhood, but there's still messages they got about how to be in the world, who they are in the world, how to see others. And maybe some of that, like I said, is working, but why are they there? Why are they sitting in my office? What is it that they're wanting? And I always ask that question, what do you want? You know, what are you looking for out of this experience? Because that's my guide. And often part of what they're wanting in terms of their growing or and healing work comes out of having an understanding about something that may or may not have happened in their family. So I always keep it, and I tell my clients that. I understand that you don't want to go back there. We're not going to go back. We don't have to go back and stay there. You know, it's not like that needs to happen. But I do want to know. I know one about you. I want to know about your experience growing up. I want to know who was there. Where are you? If there's siblings, where are you in the lineup? Because that has impact as well. What was that like to be the middle child? Or what was that like to be the only girl or the youngest child, the oldest child? So I want to hear their story about that, because I know that's how they're defining themselves, how they see themselves. And so I think that got to some of your question.
No, absolutely. You provided a lot of really wonderful examples of different things that we might have experienced that helped to mold and shape our family system. You mentioned mental illness, physical illness, divorces, losses, moves. And what you just mentioned was around even which order we were in the siblings, in our siblings. And how do some of these past experiences affect my current way of being in the world? So when you mentioned like the being the middle child or the first child or even like an only child, how does this affect how I relate to others?
Well, I don't like to make generalizations. And a lot of that comes, the birth order stuff comes from before family systems theory. There was a psychoanalyst, I believe he was a psychoanalyst, Alfred Adler, I'm pretty sure. And he came up with the birth order idea. This is before systems theory, but systems theory brought it in because it's something to look at. And it's different for different people. So I don't like to make the generalizations about it. I want to know what that meant to them. I want to know what it meant to that person who was the only child. And did they feel lonely, or did they feel special, or did they oftentimes feel like they were just a little adult walking around the house, or were they kept kind of younger, much longer, because the parents just wanted a child. So even when they were growing up, getting a little older, moving, you know, into adolescence and beyond, are they still the little boy or the little girl? So I want to know just what their experience was of that, and then move from that place. And then, okay, what meaning did they give it? What was their experience? How do they think about themselves? And how do they then think it's impacting them in their current relationship? And if I'm hearing something that has to do with that, then I might offer it as, here's a possibility that part of what, you know, what's going on with you and this person you're in relationship with might have to do with this, whatever this is. The youngest being the oldest, being the only, being the middle, whatever that may be, being the last one of 10 children who didn't get a lot of attention. So I hear all kinds of things, of course, in this long career. And I always want to make it an individual experience and not try to generalize it too much.
No, I really appreciate your emphasis on the meaning making, on the decision making, on how we all have had unique experiences and have had a unique response to those experiences. And it's those that you have to get to the bottom of. And when I do think about cultivating the awareness and understanding, I'm curious your thoughts on when people often in relationships often say things like, well, in my family, we did it this way, so we need to also do it that way. They sort of almost justify that their family system is how things are supposed to be. I even have like a really silly example. I was with a friend and she was on her computer and I was like, oh, what you're working on? And just kind of come over. And then she slams her computer shut and goes, don't look over my shoulder. I hate it when people look over my shoulder when I'm working. My mother always used to look over my shoulder. So this basic idea that like things are a certain way and I'm a certain way. And this is the way things are. Like these are the way things are going to be. Like dinner time means this. So that's how it's going to be. And how do we encourage away from that kind of my way or the highway kind of thinking?
Well, I think certainly it's going to be to listen and understand, to work on listening and understanding, rather than being, I am right, you are wrong. That I think the whole key is I'm going to listen. So in this case, if I were you, it's like, okay, I'm going to listen to my friend. She has a sensitivity about this. And it really is something that disturbs her. I don't have a problem with it, but I'm going to understand that she does. And I will try to, I'm going to respect her point of view, even though I may disagree with it, even though I may, basically disagree. I don't want to label it right or wrong. Sometimes we tend to do that. I think when we do that, we're putting ourselves in a bind, that if we can try to listen to the person, understand their point of view, they can then listen to us. So let's say it's not just about, she can say, okay, I don't want you looking over my shoulder. That's one thing. But let's say you're in a relationship with someone and it's like they always want to eat dinner at 5:30 because that's when their family ate dinner. And, the other person's like, well, no, dinner hour for me isn't until 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. It's like, okay, so maybe what does that mean to you that your dinner hour was then? Do you feel you have any flexibility around it? If there's something special around it, most people can negotiate a dinner hour, but that's a little different than do we go to mom's every Sunday evening for dinner, which is something perhaps someone has done and now they're getting in relationship and the other person doesn't want to go to that mom's every Sunday, maybe once in a while. But I've always gone. We get together every Sunday, the whole family does. This is something that we have to, okay, let's listen. Hear why it's important, understand. When you feel that you've been heard and understood, then it's important then to listen and understand the other person's point of view. And then hopefully we can, with understanding and appreciation of the other and not trying to label something right or wrong or good or bad, negotiate. But I tell couples, and I love this work by John Gottman and his wife, Julie Gottman, years ago when they were writing some of their first stuff, and they said something, and I may be a little wrong on this figure, but something like 79 or 80% of couples' issues cannot be resolved. I think it can be resolved. But so maybe then there's 20% that's not going to be resolved. All right, so if you fall in that 20% of issues that are not going to be resolved, then it's going to be feeling at least heard and understood and not judged for your point of view. That I think that any couple who can agree to disagree are going to be in a better shape than those couples where one or both people feel like they have to be right. And I would often say to couples, and I think many therapists do, say to couples, would you rather be right or be happy? Because sometimes that's a choice we make.
It's such a skill, being able to listen, being able to understand another person's point of view without that judgment, without that criticism, especially when you're like, what do you mean you like it this way? That's so irrational or something like that. And what you're saying right now reminds me of a very nice insight I read in your book, that it is important to honor your issues and don't let them become problems. And I wanted to hear more about that. How do you contrast an issue versus a problem? And how do we ensure that our issues don't become problems?
Yes, I learned that very early on because every relationship, there's going to be an issue. And if we just let it fester, we don't talk about it, what happens is we distance from one another. And if we're wanting to have a close relationship or wanting an intimate relationship, whether that's with a friend or someone that we're romantically involved with, then it's important that we can talk about these issues whatever they might be. Yeah, I think that it's really what I was just saying a few minutes ago about the listening and understanding. The thing that I see often in couples is that they're upset because they think their partner should be a mind reader. They should know this. Or, well, he should have known that I would want that. Or, you know, so they expect you to be a mind reader. And we're not mind readers. So if that's an issue, then it's important, rather than just go off and sulk or to distance or to scold, I can't believe you didn't know that I don't like carnations. You know, when you've never purchased flowers, you didn't know they like. Okay, so you're not a mind reader. So then bringing it into conversation in a way that, again, like I said, is sharing your thoughts and your feelings while the other is opening to listening and hearing you before they come up with their response. And that's where I think people have the most problem in having these dialogues, because you're already working on your response before you really have taken in what and understand what the other is saying. So if you can listen and understand and let them know that you heard them, and then once they feel heard, again, not necessarily agreed with, but they feel heard, then you can come back with your thoughts and feelings about the subject. And hopefully the other person is willing to hear, to listen, to understand. And I work with this a lot in couples work. And really, it takes some practice. We think it's just something we should all do. We don't. It takes some practice to stop, to listen, and to understand, and to let the other person know that we understand, so that they can feel understood. Again, not necessarily agreed with. So
I love that.
It doesn't have to become a problem, but
okay. Yeah, I feel the sense that I'm getting is issues are normal and problems create disconnection. And I love how you said that every relationship is going to have issues, and the ones that don't talk about it and let it fester will create distance and disconnection. And yes, disconnect in the relationship, that's a problem.
Yes, yes. It's a problem for the relationship, of course, but it's a problem for each individual, because, you know, you feel alone and misunderstood and judged, and that's no fun. So we don't want to be there if we don't have to be.
Yeah, so I'm hearing the importance of bringing up issues as they come up and remaining open to our partner when they do share these issues. And I'm curious, what about when it's either A, incredibly lopsided? In other words, one partner is always bringing up issues and the other one thinks that they're just always complaining, or lopsided in a way that one partner thinks the other partner is all of the issues. Like, yeah, we need to talk about your blah, 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 blah. Or you said this during dinner and that was really inappropriate, where it seems like, yeah, one person's always just criticizing the other one and they think it's a good thing because they're bringing up problems as they come up.
Well, yes, that's unfortunate because that doesn't work very well. And that will drive people apart, create distance. And it certainly happens. We know it happens. I'm telling you this for your own good. I'm telling you this, you know, that you did this wrong, or you could have done it better, or that they're starting off. And if it happens a lot, I think it drives a wedge in the relationship. So certainly, yeah, many times that's when they're coming in for couple therapy. And it would be to help the person realize who's the one who's always doing the criticizing and judging or bringing up the issues. Because usually when that's being done in a way that's making the other person wrong. So they're not just sharing a thought or a feeling. What's the intent? That's my question often. What is the intent? What is the intent behind that? If the intent is to get closer, to feel more connected, then there's ways to address it that can be more connecting. And so, you know, there may be some ways then that if I'm working with a couple, I could help them be able to express thoughts and feelings that, you know, instead of pushing the other away, could possibly be more connecting. and to know that perhaps the way they're doing it isn't working in terms of helping the relationship be more connected, and or helping the other person, if that's truly what they think they're doing, is often an underhanded way of just kind of beating someone over the head. So the intent really isn't to connect or help the other person. The intent is to punish. And so sometimes I will kind of call people out on what their intent is. And if that's the intent, then what's that about for them? Why would they, are they feeling the need or want to do that? If they're saying what they're wanting is more intimacy and connection, then how are they getting in their own road by behaving the way they're behaving in their interactions? So it's awareness again, awareness, understanding, and then creating new choice.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, there's an intention, and I was like, probably around the choose phase is where we can be really mindful of what our intention is and choosing the right intention so that our action does spring from that right intention.
Yeah.
So it's so interesting, like, you know, hearing the general conflict and issues that you see in relationships. And I'm thinking how universal they are. Like, we all think our relationship is super special and unique, but we just have the same conflicts that other couples have. And I'm also curious, though, because you have been working as a therapist for a very long time. Have you seen sort of changes in the ways that we relate and the conflicts that we do experience in relationship? Or is it all just the same? We all have the same fundamental needs to be seen and recognized and loved.
I haven't seen a big change in that. That is that human longing to be known, and that we're also terrified of being known.
Oh, wow.
And so I think as humans, we carry that. We so desire it. We so desire to, and long to be known and to be loved. And yet at some level, that's really frightening. So it takes a lot of courage to open up and explore that just within yourself, but also with another person to build that intimacy.
Wow, that's so powerful. We all have a human longing to be known, and we are terrified of being known. It's so true. So far, we've almost been talking about I'm an adult and I want to understand my internal family system so that I can better relate to others. And I'm curious how this affects, say, parents or soon-to-be parents raising a young child who is in charge of the family system. And what I know you said you didn't like giving everyone the same advice, but I am wondering, like, what is, yeah, the best or most robust family system that I can create? And how do I go about creating that for my family?
Yes, I think being really present in the here and now. Okay, we're all sitting at the table, but we're all thinking about what happened today, but to be really present with the child and to offer them a sense of safety and security in the world, because I really do think that's what helps a child thrive and grow, is to have that sense that they are safe and secure, at least in this relationship with the parent. And to listen, to really listen to what a child is saying. It's so easy to dismiss something because it's just maybe, you know, in adult view, not accurate. And so we dismiss it, but it's the child's experience. So to be able to really listen again, to acknowledge, and then to maybe add a different perspective or some comfort in some way. I think that supporting each child's individuality as you experience togetherness. And that means that, you know, people have a voice and that they know that, so they can be heard again. The parents need to be in charge. There has to be a executive functioning system in the family. And generally, that's a parent or parents. And it's absolutely essential for the child to feel secure that we have the executive functioning system in the parts of the system in the family. Because we want to look at how the family is structured And is it structured in a way that provides security for the child and provides support for parents? And yeah, so I think it's honoring yourself as you honor the other. So, okay, the child wants to stay up way past bedtime. Yeah, but that's not how we're going to do it. There's a boundary. Child needs limits and boundaries. They need them. They may fight them at different, particularly different stages. They fight them more. But we want to set them as parents because we know that that is what creates a sense of safety and security. And that's our job. And so I think that's important. And then as the child gets older and older, then, you know, they have more freedom around that. We're scared to let our children maybe go out into the world at times when they're ready to go out into the world and to say, okay, I can handle my anxiety about that so that I can don't have to put that on my child and let them be able to know who they are and be who they are.
So just some of the things, I love your list. Some of the things I'm hearing from you include presence, safety, security, listening, and supporting individuality by honoring yourself as you honor the other. And when you do talk about allowing our children to be who they are while setting healthy limits and boundaries, I'm curious how this ties into differentiation, which is something you talk about in your book as well, including how you write, if an adult has not successfully differentiated, then that individual cannot be free to be and feel who she truly is. So how does that connect? What's the connection between individuality and differentiation, and how do we promote that with our own children?
Yes. Well, I really, in my book, I probably said differentiation is a lifelong endeavor. We work on it our entire lives. I don't think we reach age 21 or 35 or whatever the magic age is, and we're differentiated,
okay.
Or 18 or so, whatever the magic age is we're constantly working on it. But if we have a sense of that, our feelings and our thoughts, that we can... That's not necessarily the same as the parents. And that it can be really tricky because I think so often we carry, unknowingly sometimes, we're carrying the parents' beliefs, their values, their ways of communicating. And we're carrying that and we're not really paying attention to what we're really feeling and thinking. So we can begin to separate that out. The earlier we can do that and we can give voice to that and be heard, then that's going to promote the differentiation. And then when we are in relationship with the other, we don't like, I used to hear. This is one thing I do hear that's different than you asked me this question a while ago, is I used to hear a lot more of individuals talking about how they would get lost in relationship or get swallowed up. In the relationship. I don't hear that as much anymore. But I do think that has to do with being able to have your own thoughts and feelings separate from the other, whether that's a parent, whether that's a love interest, that we have our own individual thoughts and feelings, and that we honor those as we know that the other person has theirs as well.
Yeah, I think that's such an important insight, particularly as a kind of way to avoid codependency or enmeshment, is to recognize that this process of differentiation is lifelong.
It is.
Wonderful. So thank you so much, Elaine Carney Gibson, for coming on to the show, author of Your Family Revealed, A Guide to Decoding the Patterns, Stories, and Belief Systems in Your Family. Before I let you go, I have to ask you the question I ask all of my guests, which is, what do you wish everyone knew about love?
That they understand that it comes from within, that it's an energy that we choose. I meditate every day, and as part of my closing for my meditation is, may I be a loving presence, that I really... think that that's really that we, there's an old show that was on TV in 1970. It came out, Mary Tyler Moore Show, and it had a theme song. And one of the lines was, let's see, love, Love is all around. Do not waste it. I was young. I was very young, but I thought, okay, what does that mean? Love is all around. Do not waste it. I've thought about that for the last whatever many years, 50 something years. Love is all around. Do not waste it. And it is. Can you embrace? Can you feel it inside? Create that energy. Be with that energy in you. And know that it is around you, and to be able to embrace that energy.
Such beautiful words. Thank you so much, Elaine Gibson, for coming on to the show, for sharing us your absolute wealth of wisdom from years of experience. I so appreciate you coming on. And for our listeners that want to learn more about you, how can they find you?
Well, they can go to my website. Of course, do I remember what it is? I think it's ElaineKearneyGibson.com. And look up the book if they need to, Your Family Revealed, and that'll take you to the website. Yeah, and I'm happy to people email me. They can get in touch with me. There's also the Link Counseling Center in Atlanta, Georgia, and there's phone numbers for that. So that's be the way to do it. And I so appreciate your having me on. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again, Elaine, for coming on to the show. And thank you, listeners, for listening to the show. We hope you remember all of the valuable lessons that Elaine shared with us today, including that our family system really has to do with the meaning we have been given and how we define ourselves, such as the messages we give ourselves. Do we tell ourselves that we're worthy and lovable and a good person? Remember that every relationship is going to have issues. It's important to talk about them, not let them fester and become problems. When you do talk about them, listen and understand the other without labeling right or wrong or good or bad. Remember, we all have a human longing to be known, and we are terrified of being known. So create that healthy family system through presence, safety, security, listening, and supporting individuality by honoring yourself as you honor the other. And you heard it here, love comes from within. May we all be loving presences in the world. Love is all around. Do not waste it. If you want to learn more about me, you can go to zachbeach.com. Learn more about the show at theheartcenter.com. Thanks again, Elaine.
Thank you, Zach. I enjoyed this very much. You're a lovely interviewer.
Thank you. You're a lovely guest.
Thanks again for listening to the Learn to Love podcast. To learn more about the show and your host, head over to zachbeach.com or theheartcenter.com. You can also follow Zach on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.